Welcome back, everybody, to Radio Imbibe from Imbibe Magazine. I'm Paul Clark, the executive editor of Imbibe, and it is officially autumn. If we were one of those traditional fashion magazines or a men's publication like Esquire or GQ, we'd be giving you all kinds of ideas of how to fill out your cool weather wardrobe with cardigans and boots and that kind of thing, and reminding you of the kinds of rules of thumb like not wearing white after Labor Day. But we're a drinks magazine, so I can't really help you with how you should dress this time of year. And while I'm totally fine with you continuing to drink white spirits after Labor Day, this is the time of year when aged spirits like whiskey and brandy start showing up in the glass with a bit more regularity. Our September-October issue this year has a cover feature on rum, so we're going to revisit that subject in this episode to some degree. And to get you better equipped for digging into those nice aged rums, we're getting things started with some experienced insight into mixing with rum from one of our favorite people in the rum world. Our September-October issue takes a deep dive into the rum world, looking at its history and variety of styles, as well as introducing you to some of the people and places that are driving today's rum conversation. Among those places we covered is Smuggler's Cove in San Francisco, and among the people we spoke with about rum and rum cocktails is that bar's co-owner and the co-author of Smuggler's Cove with his wife Rebecca, Martin Cape. A lot of the time when we have rum cocktail recipes sent to us or when we're browsing through menus for rum drinks, so many rum drinks have a citrus component or a juice component to them, whether it's, you know, something in a Caribbean direction like a daiquiri, its relatives, or something more tropically oriented in which, you know, a number of different juices and sweeteners and so on are deployed and then shaken or blended together. But you've got a stirred rum drink for us today. What's up with that? What are you doing?
Well, a couple of things. When you reached out to me and I thought about what I would do and talk about, that was a little different. And I mean, everyone knows that you can use a great rum in a stirred drink, but I really thought it actually is a little bit more kind of timely for me right now, at least personally. I kind of have been doing this a lot lately, and a lot of it is really because I think sometimes maybe people assume that I'm at home and on a, you know, leisurely Friday night, I'm going to just whip up a zombie. But in the real world, and certainly in the pandemic world, I don't typically even have any citrus around the house. So I kind of thought, well, I mean, the reality is anything I'm making at home in the last 6 months has basically been, with very rare exceptions, stirred. And that's kind of a, you know, both a process or a result of my own unwillingness to go to the grocery store or really use a shaker. So I like to sort of think that the stirring is basically kind of the result of my adopting a wartime posture, for lack of a better term. And I've been having a lot of fun experimenting with different rums and different modifiers to make interesting stirred drinks. And certainly taking advantage of, as I also like to say, getting high on my own supply. What are we going to drink tonight? I don't know. Drive into the bar and steal things. Okay. So just what I do. So are we out of vermouth? Yeah, I think we're out of vermouth. Go down, drive to the bar and steal some. Okay, great. So it's not exactly a sound business model, but at this point, haha. So yeah, I've been doing a lot of stirring. So, and I think it's a lot of fun because doing these stirred drinks is a great way to highlight the diversity in the category and how much fun you can have between the huge range of styles of rums, or whether or not you're actually blending different styles of rums together. And, you know, it's a lot of fun because there's a lot of just hit and miss. Sometimes you find, hey, actually, this particularly funky Jamaican rum really seemed to benefit from this modifier, or this modifier might have overwhelmed this rum because this rum is a little more delicate and things like that.
We've talked a number of times about how using different rums and different styles of rum in one drink can really kind of tap into rum's versatility. When you're talking about stirred cocktails and these different kinds of nuances and characteristics and interplay within the cocktail, rum still lends that kind of platform to it. But as you were saying, different styles of rum work better with different styles of modifiers. What kinds of things have you found from different styles of rum that work well with different modifiers?
Sure. I mean, I think some of the things, like when I am drinking a rum that's kind of like a nice medium-bodied, well-aged rum that's got classic sort of long-aged American oak vanilla notes, like, you know, like a nice Barbadian rum, for example, I like to mix the things that I detect already in the rum. I mean, it's almost when you kind kind of do a rum tasting, sit down, nose it, spend some time with it and say, I get hints of this or I get hints of that. Well, that's another great opportunity to take those notes that you just say, oh, I got a little bit of cinnamon on this, or I got a little bit of chocolate. Now you might want to say, okay, well then either I'm going to use a modifier that is going to accent that cinnamon note, or I'm going to use a modifier that's going to complement that cinnamon note. Maybe I want something more, you know, for example, obviously Angostura bitters is so big on the cinnamon note. So it's some way to do that. In our book, we've got a drink called the Chadburn, which is I get these nice sort of mellow, mature fruity notes, and I find like a little bit of pear liqueur and a tawny port to have a little bit of that oxidized flavor. In this case, it's pear liqueur, tawny port, and chocolate mole bitters, which I think really accent nice medium-bodied rums. I mean, you're kind of taking this model. You're basically taking the classic, it's a rum Manhattan. Let's just start there. And that's my base point. Now, what am I going to do? Am I going to stay with an aromatized fortified wine with it, or I'm going to move into liqueurs? I like things that accent those in a molasses rum. I like things that accent those baking spice notes, like tawny port and things like that. When I'm using agricole rum, I like things that taste kind of herbaceous. Because I think it's complementary to the grassiness of an agricole rum. There's another drink in the book that uses a rum agricole blanc, AOC rum agricole blanc, and a little bit of drambuie for sort of the honey and heather notes, and green chartreuse for, you know, and that's one of those like drambuie and green chartreuse together are something to be used, you know, extraordinarily judiciously. You know, it's like that's the other note that I would like to take away from this is that it's especially with a delicate rum, especially with a rum that might be a lighter body, the column still rum, for example, that's really got a lot of, you know, delicate character, like an English Harbor rum, for example, that I really want to be really light on the accent notes, not just because I don't want to overwhelm it with sugar. I just don't want to overwhelm it with flavors. And especially if I'm using something like an Amaro, which is going to be kind of big and, you know, it's going to put more of a test to the rum. So yeah, you know, kind of rule of thumb, you can say that a strong high ester Jamaican rum has a lot more power to stand up to a larger volume of modifier and or a more pungent modifier. You know, only Jamaican rum can stand up to Fernet, you know. That's sort of the general rule of thumb. And you can take these kind of modifiers, like that drink I was just mentioning, the Chadburn, with the port, pear, and the chocolate bitters. You can take all of those supporting ingredients and you can keep them really restrained and back. And the drink has a more preprandial quality, or you can boost them a little bit and take the drink into dessert territory because it's got natural desserty flavors, pears, port, chocolate. So you can, that's a nice spectrum that you can maintain control of.
So tell us what you've got going on today.
So today I'm making a drink that we created for our 10th anniversary last year, and it was a two-part drink. This was born out of an idea I had where I was looking at the structure of a classic exotic cocktail and thinking, okay, here we've got rums or base rums. We've got our modifiers, liqueurs, like your falernums and things like that. And we've got our fresh citrus on top. And you've got what makes these great exotic cocktails, this long, nice, long layered journey. But I was thinking about the idea of, at that base of it, you've got a stirred drink. You've got rums and modifiers by themselves. And I kind of set myself to the task of, how do I make a drink that is the exact same core and just has various citruses and things added to it? Like, how could I make it work proportionally that made sense? In that you could take this one drink, you could simply take these first five ingredients, stir them, strain them, call it a day, or you could take those first five ingredients, add four more in the realms of pineapple and passion fruit and things like that, and it would work long and fruity as well, but without changing the ratio of the core. And so that was a little bit of a challenge, but I came up with this drink and I'm really happy with it. It's called, and because it's a two-part drink, it's got a two-part name, and it gave me a final excuse to use a drink name I'd been saving. I'm sure, like many, many mixologists, you keep a little notebook of favorite drink names that you don't have, they don't have homes for yet, and save them. And this will let me use Shipshape and Bristol Fashion as a drink name. So the stirred version is the Shipshape, add fruit, and it becomes the Bristol Fashion. So, but collectively, the drinks are called the Shipshape and Bristol Fashion. So this drink, so this is the Shipshape. So phase one is to create, and this is just to do at home, so it's nice and easy and makes life a little faster, is the core mix of modifiers, which we call high C's mix. And so high C's mix is very simply equal parts Averna, Swedish Punch, and Oloroso Sherry. And so this modifier base, this, so I just have that sitting on the counter in a bottle ready to go. And then I just grab a rum and I'll see, maybe I'll take a blend of rums, maybe it'll be just one rum, and I'll say, I'm going to make a Shipshape with this. And then because that modifier, because that high C's mix, it's pretty pungent and it's sweet, again, I can dial it back if I want something drier, or if I'm worried about losing the subtlety of the rum to this, you know, complex blend, or I can bring it up again if it's, especially if I'm facing, staring down the barrel of a cask strength, you know, Worthy Park release or something like that. So in this drink, we're going to take, in this case, I'm making it with 2 ounces of a barrel-proof English Harbor that we had bottled for Smuggler's Cove. But it also is great. There's a terrific range of cask strength rums from Chairman's that were around. That's another fun choice to use. There's big things like OFTD, which can fight anything. There's big things, you know, there's great luxury things like the Worthy Park 12 that's got a great strength to it, which stands up really well. Some of the bigger, I think, like Nobiliary, some of the higher alcohol by volume releases from Foursquare work really well at this. So I'm taking 2 ounces of that, and then I'm just taking it against, in this case, I normally would do an ounce of the high C's mix, but I'm going to tape it back a little bit because I'm using a rum today that's all column still, even though it's high proof, it's all column still. So I'm going to take it back to about like a scant, you know, scant 3/4, maybe even just a little shy. So I don't know if you can hear my exotic mixology. It's happening right now in real life. So just that, I'm going to chuck a dash of Ango into this thing and then hit it with some ice and stir and strain. Again, it's like, you know, I mean, I got no time to be messing around with the, with limes today. I'm all about let me have the flavor, and let's get this plane off the runway. So I, you know, desperate times. So all right, well, there we go, and it looks like I'm having a breakfast cocktail. So thanks for that, Paul, because this feels like a big win.
So you use 2 ounces of the rum, and like you said, you're using a column distilled rum, you know, that's a little bit more delicate. If you were using one of those more robust rums, like OFTD or one of the Foursquare cask strength, then you would bump up your high C's mix a little bit more. Would it be like closer to an ounce or something?
Yeah, I would give it a full ounce if I was going at it with something really strong. Like at the bar, we do a 50-50 blend of the of a bottling we had done at St. Lucia Distillers of cask strength, 100% John Doerr pot still rum, and a 105 proof Jamaican that was bottled for Smuggler's Cove by Plantation. So it's they're coming in big in this drink at the bar, so it can definitely stand up to a bold mix. And of course, you've got some high ester at the base of the Swedish Punch already, so there's some of that in there. Yeah, that's, to me right now, is just where my head's at, and I'm really enjoying these experiments. And to be sure, some things don't work out. You know, some things you're like, this came out too sweet, or this overwhelmed the rum. It's lost in the mix here. So sometimes happy accidents. I mean, it's not like it's going to go down the sink. I'm still going to drink it. This is, again, I've adopted a wartime posture.
So and so for when you're finishing that drink, so you've stirred it and you strained it just into a cocktail glass.
Yeah, strained into a chilled coupe, and then one of the nice things at home is there's always coupes in the freezer. And then in this case, I'll express a little orange peel on it. which is nice and complimentary. So just a little peel oil over the top and drop, and that's it. So, but yeah, I think this is where the fun lies. And I think this is where I want people to experience the broadness of the category, to go down to your good spirits retailer or even maybe a good bar, be some states where you can sell whole bottles right now, like I can, and pick up something interesting and fun and different, and then just play with it in really small doses. And you just want to keep it interesting.
Well, thank you for joining us and for making this for us. And the last time I saw you was just about a month before everything shut down. So I can't wait for our paths to cross again, hopefully before too much more time passes.
I hope so too, sir. I absolutely miss bending elbows with you and look forward to doing it again.
Check out Martin and Rebecca Cate's James Beard Award-winning book, Smuggler's Cove, for more rum and rum cocktail insight. And be sure to visit us at imbibemagazine.com for much more rum knowledge. We're going to have more rum for you shortly, but first, every January, we feature our Imbibe 75 list of people, places, destinations, and directions that are going to influence the way we drink in the days to come. In 2018, for our Beer People of the Year, we recognized Benny Ashburn and Teo Hunter, the duo behind Dope and Dank, an outreach effort that aimed to unite the worlds of Black and Brown people in craft beer. Teo and Benny have been keeping up their beer work with another project, Crowns and Hops, with several beers currently available and a brewery opening before long in Los Angeles, and they're keeping their beer-related activism front and center with a new project, the 8 Trill Pills Initiative. Listen closely, because Benny and Teo are about to fill us in. Back in 2018, we named you two our Beer People of the Year as part of our Imbibe 75 for your beer outreach work via Dope and Dank. Now in 2020, as the founders of Crowns and Hops, you've got two beers in production and an upcoming brewery in Los Angeles, as well as a new project, the 8 Trill Pills Initiative. Let's start by bringing us up to speed on where you are with Crowns and Hops.
I'm T.O. Hunter, now COO and head of brewing operations for Crowns and Hops.
I'm Benny Ashburn, the CEO of Crowns and Hops Brewing Company.
Yeah, and first and foremost, thank you to you, Paul, and the whole Imbibe team. I think enough can be said about the way that Imbibe recognized our efforts back in 2017 to really give us give us the honor of being Beer People of the Year before we had even started brewing. I think we always have to remind people that we had been doing quite a bit of work in the industry for advocacy of not only craft beer, but also advocating for our community, which there was just a complete void of at the time. So I think, again, we give a lot of credit to those who saw us before the masses did.
Yeah, I mean, we have recognized your work and acknowledged your work for a long time, and we're really excited to see where you're coming from. And so now this next step here in the summer of 2020, getting to the autumn of 2020, really excited to see what these next steps are.
Yeah, no, I think when we first connected with you guys, again, we were Dope and Dank, and our focus at that moment was to really curate content and experiences, introducing more people of color into the craft beer space. And at that point, we were simply just promoting other people's beer. And then as we fast forward into 2019, when we officially launched Crowns and Hops Brewing Co., we always say Crowns and Hops Brewing Company is the physical manifestation of what Dope and Dank was. It is now our physical flagship location that, as you mentioned, we're in the process of building in Inglewood. It is now our physical products being on shelf, which we have some of our flagship on shelves right now. And then secondly, it's our 8 Trill Pills Initiative, which we've realized we've always been focused and pushing for racial equity inside of the craft beer space. And I'll turn it over to Teo to tell you more about our 8 Trill Pills Initiative.
Sure. And just to take a step back as far as the brand is concerned, we've been fortunate enough to have quite a few beers out now. We created a beer called BPLB, which was clearly an ode to our community. Black and Brown People Love Beer, which was a hazy IPA that we brewed a few versions of. We also were fortunate enough to take part in the Black is Beautiful beer, which clearly, Marcus Baskerville and the Weathered Souls team really led, you know, the industry with regards to drawing awareness of injustices in the criminal justice system. But now we're about to lean into our flagship beers, which are stout called Urban Anomaly, IPA that's currently out right now called Elevated Cipher, which is a West Coast IPA, and a Pilsner that is called Beat Messenger to accompany BPLB. But yes, we obviously, just with our presence, are not only just in the practice of trying to start and create a successful craft beer company, but also we have to remain activists. You know, I think the moment we take our eyes off of the fact that we have to champion for racial equity in this industry, we don't allow for the ones coming behind us to not see and experience the same pitfalls that Benny and I have experienced on our journey of attempting to open a craft beer business.
Fill us in a little bit more on how you came up with this project and on the significance of the name, because I thought that was really moving when I saw the some of the background behind this project.
Benny and I came across an amazing report by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation called A Business Case for Racial Equity. When we really explored that document, we, one, realized that we ourselves were that case of racial equity within our own industry, which is craft beer. We also saw that the report cited that if you reduce the disparities as it relates to the domains that make a community or a society productive, then you stand to see and realize an ultimate benefit. So by diminishing the lack of resources and healthcare and housing, education, criminal justice, entrepreneurship, and employment, you create a more equitable society. And the report states that by 2050, if we focus on racial equity today, that the country stands to realize an impact of $8 trillion to the national GDP. What's even more jarring is that when we finally had an opportunity to connect with the Kellogg Foundation, we found out that that was the basement. That is the minimum amount that can be accomplished if we start focusing on racial equity, which is truly a strategy for economic growth. It's not a charity game. It's not a zero-sum game, as people put it. You know, someone doesn't have to lose for others to win. Rather, in this particular model, the more people have access and resources to win, the more we all collectively win.
Yeah, so Atrial Pills, we have three really key initiatives under that umbrella. The first one is the Atrial Pills Fund, which is a $100,000 grant supported by BrewDog that will be giving to a few Black-owned craft beer brands to help them in the business of beer. You know, as Tio mentioned, our focus is to really help other brands really not have to struggle as much as we did. When we first started, you know, 5-6 years ago, there were very little resources. There are very little tools available to help understand how to build a craft beer brewery at all and or any kind of craft beer business. So our focus is, one, to provide capital to Black-owned craft beer brands. Secondly, we just launched 2 weeks ago our Atrial Pills Pilsner that we brewed in Germany.
Which is delicious.
Which is very delicious. Very, very, very delicious, which we brewed in three countries, again, Germany, UK, and the US. And 100% of the proceeds from that beer are going to organizations focused on achieving racial equity in the US. And that's Race Forward in the UK. That's Kwanda. And in Berlin, it's an organization called Black Brown Berlin. We were also able to, you know, dip back into some of our dope and dank roots and work with Black artists in those three countries to design the label artwork. So when you look at the Atrial Pills artwork, you can see they're very three distinct can designs that we're really very proud of, really amazing artists. And then lastly, to Tio's point, atrialpills.org really is meant to be a resource and a tool to help people beyond just finances. There's legal, there's marketing, there's recipe development, there's contract brewing. It's all of this information that's really just not readily available to many of us, and specifically to Black-owned craft beer brands, that we want to pay for it and assist other brands to help them be successful.
How do you envision the operation of this fund, and how will you be selecting recipients?
We're in the process of creating the criteria for that now. Clearly, we don't want to be solely, you know, the sole deciders of this. So we are creating a board to assist us in selecting that. Again, it clearly takes more than any denomination of $100,000 to to open a brewery. But there are several ways that we can help the process, you know, whether it be in providing resources in addition to capital that help get someone in a position to ultimately receiving the funding or the investment needed to realize their ultimate goal. So with the assistance of a board, with the assistance of the individuals that are in our lives right now, with regards to consultants that we use from a beer standpoint, a brewery standpoint, and from a business standpoint. Again, to Benny's point, it's more than just brewing a beer when it comes down to having a successful brand. You know, there is the marketing strategy. There are the financials that need to be solid for someone to put themselves in a position to ultimately receive that investment. So our goal is to not necessarily own this concept of 8 Trills, but rather it'd be a resource for the industry. We're calling on professionals throughout the entire ecosystem of craft beer to sign up and to make themselves available through 8 Trills so that we can really make a dent in what it means to increase racial equity in craft beer. Even if we just increased it by 1%, I think Benny and I would be thrilled. You know, I mean, you know, again, considering the fact that, you know, there's approximately 8,000 breweries, hopefully it's still that amount due to COVID, but even if we just increased it by, you know, 1%, we would be at 80 breweries. You know, which sounds absurd that we would be hopeful for just 20 more breweries, but to get, you know, ultimately, you know, 20%, you know, I think would be an incredible feat. So as Benny and I have accepted the fact that we are not going to get this thing 100% right the very first time. And if anything, we have proven is we're okay with making mistakes publicly. We're okay with going in the right direction publicly, but we will take action always. And that has been a part of our ethos, has been a part of who we are.
The other thing to consider too is I think the brand that me and Tio have built is very unique, you know, inside of the craft beer space. You know, we started our brand using social media tools, which, you know, a lot of craft beer brands really aren't used to using, aren't familiar with using. So we not only want to be a resource to other Black-owned craft beer brands, but we're also a resource as entrepreneurs, right? Like we have a different business model that we want to help share with other people so they can understand how to pivot. You know, COVID was really hard for a lot of craft beer brands, and there was a lot of pivoting that needed to happen that a lot of breweries weren't able to necessarily adapt to. You had to look at marketing in a new way. You had to look at how you were communicating with your audience.
Just to tag on to Benny's point, you know, there are a lot of brands that did understand that social media was an aspect of the business, but just as many as there were that had an appreciation for it and that utilized it properly, there were just as many brands that demonized it and that made it seem as though it were just a tool to reinforce and to instigate hype versus what we used it as is to galvanize a community that did not have a voice. Not that we speak for every Black person or every brown person in the country. You know, we have the hope of showcasing our culture as we know it through our lens, which we have learned many people share.
As I said at the outset, we had first talked to you guys a couple of years ago about this, and we've seen how far you've come with the new brewery coming up and with the beers of your own, and now with the 8 Trill Pils initiative. We're really excited to see how this unfolds in the months and the years to come. So we want to see some of those breweries you're working with and get some of those folks into the magazine, on the podcast, and drink your beer.
And well, look, it almost goes without saying. I think almost every time you guys do a top 75, it includes someone who we've worked with in the past or someone that we're currently working with, from, you know, the young Brandon Montgomery, Black Beer Traveler, to Ashton Berry, who received accolades for her advocacy in the hospitality industry, you know, to the Cocktail Bandits. You know, you know, we all are fairly close, and I think we all lean on each other to really advocate in the spaces that we do. So again, our hats off to Imbibe for just really showcasing and shining a light on something that in many circles was being reduced or are not seen as something that was significant. So again, thank you guys for stepping out on a limb and championing something that you guys believed in.
And then lastly, I'll say thank you for, you know, co-signing what we knew we were doing, that we really, really believed in. I think it's really hard when you're pushing your passion. And, you know, you see the vision and you see the light at the end of the tunnel. But when you guys came in and named us Beer People of the Year, which wasn't even anything we thought we could expect to receive, again, having had no product on shelves, it literally lit a fire under us. to not only honor you guys for calling us that and naming us that, but it also really showed us that the work we were doing was really important. And it was important, and it was recognized by a very respected media publication. So we honestly thank you for that.
Yeah, I think a lot of times we used to tell everybody, like, man, like, this is a win-win. Like, it is why are you trying to make something that is meant to be a win-win? Like, the more people that know about your beer, the better your brewery is going to do.
So it's exactly.
But I think immediately, many times people wanted to reduce it to it being politics or being taboo to discuss, when ultimately it's truly a benefit to all of us.
To find out more about Benny and Tio's beer and upcoming brewery, visit crownsandhops.com. And for more about the initiative and related projects, head to 8trillpills.org. You can find links to these in the detailed notes accompanying this episode. Okay, I promised we had more rum in this episode, so let's head to Barbados, where we're going to hear from Trudy Ann Branker, the master blender at Mount Gay Distillery, about the world of Barbados rum and what she's up to at Mount Gay. Earlier this year in the magazine, we introduced readers to Trudy Ann Branker, who recently assumed the role of master blender at Mount Gay Rum in Barbados. We wanted to check in with her and see what's coming up in the world of Mount Gay and Barbados rum. So, Trudy Ann, thank you for joining us.
No problem. Lovely to be here.
Now, Barbados has a significant role in rum history, and Mount Gay is a significant part of that history. For people who are just starting out their explorations of rum, how would you say Barbados rum and Mount Gay rum fit into the rum spectrum? What makes Barbados rum so distinctive?
Well, what makes Barbados rum distinctive, especially Mount Gay rum, is our oldest running distillery. Been doing this for over 300 years. And, you know, with all of that heritage, with all of that expertise, it really puts us in a position to define a lot what type of rum we want to put out there, what type of rum think our client or our consumer wants. So for us, if you get back to specific styles, you know, we have a more drier style. For Mount Gay specifically, we always use pot stills, and that really comes through in our rum. And just to backtrack a little bit, you know, pot stills were the original way in which we made rum, and we still do it that way up to today, you know. So I think these are kind of just a few of the things that define Mount Gay and define Barbadian rum. And, you know, and I always try not to focus so much on, you know, like the history of it, but it's, you know, you can't say that we've been operating for over 300 years and not elaborate on the fact that, you know, this was one of the original ways of making rum.
And now, you recently assumed the role of master blender, and as part of your job, you're revisiting some of the distillery's expressions, like XO and Black Barrel. What's prompting this revisitation, and what can we expect to see?
Well, this revisit is really, you know, I guess a culmination of my journey to taking over the role as master blender. You know, as I would have been getting more familiar with our barrels and the liquids in our barrels under our previous master blender, Alan Smith, there were, you know, two things that really stood out. One, master blender to master blender really taught to make rum the Mount Gay way and not the way our predecessor did it. So there are certain key Mount Gay profiles that we look for in each barrel, that we taste, that we smell, that we seek after. And two, the ability to, you know, just really express what Mount Gay has in our bonds. And, you know, that creativity and that craft that we've been putting down for over 300 years or so. But so for me, it was, you know, all of that summed up my journey to becoming master blender. And when I became master blender, you know, to have a company or, you know, the Remy Control and by a bigger extent, Mount Gay say, you know, sure, Trudy Ann, we trust your vision on these blends. Yes, we're going to change our labeling. We're going to change how we package the product so that it fits the liquid was quite an honor. And that doesn't happen very often. It's not a privilege given to many master blenders. Right. So no getting to what to expect from this change. Eclipse, there's no change. That blend stays the same. However, you know, there have been some changes made for Black Barrel and for XO. And like I said, it was really about my journey to becoming master blender. So specifically for Black Barrel, what you will see that is different is the liquid is now 3 to 7 years. It's aged up. You know, there is You know, I spoke about the pot stills earlier and how that's a very integral part of how we make rum. So, you know, there's a higher proportion of pot still in this new flat barrel, as well as a longer finishing period. Because, again, important to me was, you know, understanding and diving deeper into what black barrel. And it was specifically that finishing that happened in the heavily charred bourbon. So, you know, finding the liquids that complemented that more, you know, that led to the age up, increasing the pot still, and then on top of everything else, increasing finishing time that it would spend in that barrel. Again, black barrel is unique for us. It's the only liquid we have that goes through a finishing period after the blend has been made. And the changes you see for XOR, really more an enriching of the product itself. The liquid is now 5 to 17 years, but that's not the biggest change. The biggest change is that introduction of a third cask. And, you know, it really just brings the family of products together where you see the progression from Eclipse to Black Barrel to XO. And for me, the XO blend holds a special place in my heart. They all do, but because this is the blend that has seen the most master blenders in terms of being able to make slight changes and crafting it in a way that is the same to the consumer, but unique to each of us. And, you know, I wanted you to be able to still resonate with that blend, still have all those memories that come when you drink it. But, you know, it's really just bumped up a bit by the cognac cask, you know, enhancing that flow, complementing the oak notes a little more. And for me, that's the progression of the liquids.
Now, as you mentioned earlier, Mount Gay uses pot distillation, but you also use column distillation, and you have this extensive inventory of aged rum matured in different types of wood. As a blender, what kind of toolbox does this provide you when you're thinking about things like innovation or planning out future releases?
Yeah, I always like to tell people that, you know, innovation starts at fermentation, but that's really not where innovation starts. Innovation starts at molasses. Innovation continues into your fermentation and your different fermentation type. And I don't mean type, by using, like, you know, different raw materials, because we are very molasses based. And to be called rum, you need to be made from a product of sugarcane, or be it juice, sugarcane, honey, you know, molasses, any of those things. But when you innovate with longer fermentation times, you know, we have our indigenous yeast that we use. So fermentation is the real start of innovation for me. And then we distill where, you know, we get all those different marks. We have those different still types. At Mount Gay, we actually have 3 different types of stills. We have our traditional column stills, we have our pot stills, and then we have our coffee still. And then within those pot stills, we also have our Spanish stills versus our Scottish still. So you can see where the toolbox is starting to get larger and larger already, and we haven't even come to wood types yet. And for us at Mount Gay, what is key is aging all of those different liquids separately. And that really gives you all the different, you know, widgets or in the toolbox itself, so that when you come to make the final blend, you can now pull on all these different liquids that would have been aged in different casks and basically giving different profiles for the rum itself. So yeah, the toolbox, you can see it gets immense as you go from step to step to step.
Now, in some ways, rum can function as kind of an ambassador for its home country, introducing people around the world to places like Barbados or Jamaica and giving a glimpse of its culture. How integral is rum in the daily culture of Barbados, and what do you hope rum drinkers around the world can learn and understand about the island when they're coming across Barbados rum?
I'm going to answer that in 2 parts. First part, how integral is rum into the culture of Barbados? It's very everyday, and I mean that because we are from an island filled with sugarcane, and you know, for many, many years, rum was very synonymous with sugarcane. And you know, on every corner there is a rum shop. But I say that not to mean that, you know, it's necessarily that's the avenue for rum into household, but it is what that used to mean. You know, that was really a liming spot. You know, that was a where people could come together and de-stress and spend time with each other and just, you know, really be part of a community. So you know that really was the goal or the standpoint for which rum brought Barbadian culture together. For the rest of the world, yeah, I mean, you know, one thing you can know about rum is that each rum from each island is different because we all put our different spins on it. Like I said, Barbados, we have a drier style simply because, you know, it is our pot still component that adds to that. And, you know, it's really a journey around the Caribbean. You know, when you go to the French islands, you know, you're going to get use that juice. So you're going to get that more grassy, nice, sweeter profile coming through. So it's really a journey from island to island as you enjoy rum from each of the countries.
Well, Trudy and Branker, thank you so much for spending the time with us and going over Mount Gay rum and Barbados rum.
Anytime. As you can tell, I love talking about rum. And definitely love talking about Barbados.
We've had a cocktail, we've had beer, we've had rum. That's a pretty good day, so let's chalk it up as a win. And that's it for this episode. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or your favorite podcast platform to keep up with future episodes. And head to imbibemagazine.com for more on what we're up to. Keep up with us day to day by checking us out on Instagram, Twitter, Pinterest, and Facebook. And I'd love it if everyone listening to this podcast subscribed to the print and or digital issues because we're really proud of what we do. Just head to the link in the episode notes to subscribe. I'm Paul Clark, and this is Radio Imbibe. Catch you again in a couple of weeks.